Right now it is time for David Terachuk and the Media Beat. Of course, David joins us live on a Friday. You can find David at his own website, themediabeat.us. He is a person who you will find on PBS, a television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And we have him this morning once again on Robin Hood Radio. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Reporting in to you from the media capital of the world, New York City. However, it seems like my old home city, London, looks like it's vying at the moment to be the media capital of the world. Not only Brexit yet again, but yes, the final arrest by London police of Julian Assange of WikiLeaks. So yes, we're the center of attention once more, global attention.
Well, I wanted to ask you a question about that.
I thought you might.
My feelings on this guy, Julian Assange, ranged from at first he was doing something truly terrific, allowing whistleblowers access to where there would be none. But now I sit here much later, and he cites a claim as a journalist, and over the past 12 years, his actions have not been that of a journalist. They really haven't.
You're not alone in your misgivings, it has to be said. Yes, WikiLeaks professed great campaigning virtues when it first burst upon the scene. Do you remember when, I think, for a very good journalistic purpose, well before the big dump in 2010 of the videos especially, but all sorts of files from the State Department and the U.S. military, which is the cause of a great deal of concern. And some of those, of course, were valuable to have made public, of course, especially the video of a helicopter troop ship shooting people in Iraq who clearly were not terrorists fighting back. And indeed, two of the people killed turned out to be journalists themselves working for Reuters, local employees in Iraq of the Reuters news agency. But even before that, as I was saying, there was the very revealing expose of the military operating manual used for what came to be seen as American torture in Guantanamo base against people held captive there. So yeah, when first coming into international view, WikiLeaks were regarded as an important contribution to the free press worldwide. Not actually technically journalists, but providing a publishing platform, if you like. And that role has been somewhat compromised over time. You might be forgiven for changing your attitude towards WikiLeaks and to the leader of WikiLeaks himself, who's, it has to be said, has behaved like a very erratic individual. And WikiLeaks for a long time was indeed a very much a one-man show. It was the Julian Assange show, and anyone who worked for WikiLeaks had to accept that fact. And he was an erratic leader and an erratic man in his private life, and turned out to be an erratic guest of the Ecuadorian government, where because they of course gave him asylum in the London embassy, but then came to regret it, and that's one of the reasons that the Ecuadorians allowed the British police yesterday to storm in and take him into custody. He of course resisted arrest. The Ecuadorians assisted in his arrest. They were particularly anxious not to allow him back to his computer, where he seemed to have been threatening some kind of panic button response to any action taken against him. The Ecuadorians were fearful of what he might be revealing about his hosts. all part of behavior that had become not exactly respectful behavior for a guest towards his hosts. Some of the details are rather unpleasant, but he wasn't very popular in the end amongst Ecuadorians at that embassy, and certainly not popular with the current president of Ecuador, who took a very different line from his predecessor, who gave him the asylum in the first place.
You know, what amazes me is that he could not be satisfied with the incredible success he had with the early releases, with all the documents that came out. You have to remember, his first big dump of stuff on WikiLeaks, in my opinion, helped lead to the Arab Spring, because it opened up the eyes of the world as to how these countries interact with one another, and not necessarily against Israel as per se. But then it almost became like a vendetta machine that he wanted to use primarily against one person, and that would be Hillary Clinton. Now, whether or not she deserved it, because Hillary Clinton obviously had it in for him as well. But it just turned into this whole soap opera, which turned just unbelievably sour towards the end. And to see him pulled out of the embassy like he was pulled out, it's just almost shows what he became, being locked inside of, well, how many years was he in there for?
I think it was 8 years.
Yeah, I mean, amazing.
No, I may be exaggerating. 7 years. It's probably more accurate.
It's one of those stories. The biggest dumps of information in the world, security breaches, are all associated with Julian Assange, and it's
except for the very important ones about the NSA unwarranted surveillance of American citizens. Yeah. So that was dumped by Edward Snowden, who I think people, I know even professional colleagues of mine get the two of them mixed up, these two individuals, but they're very different.
Supposedly, though, what came out in it is that some of the information that Snowden dumped, of course, was helpful through WikiLeaks, but I guess what I'm saying is he really did put sunlight where it should have been, but then, like Icarus, I think he just flew too close to the sun.
Well, who knows what happened, but he certainly not behaved with the kind of principled approach to information that he claimed to profess at the very beginning, and indeed, while he'll still profess those same high freedom of speech values as time went on, his practice was somewhat compromised. There wasn't just the matter of the vendetta, what apparent vendetta against Hillary Clinton. It was the certainly does appear to be an extraordinary willingness to act as a tool of Russian intelligence gathering. The information from the Democratic campaign in 2016 that WikiLeaks published, directed by Assange from his little room inside the Ecuadorian embassy, was in fact material that every bit of evidence points to having been obtained by Russians, part of their involvement in the American election of 2016. That's not the behavior of a principled journalist. It's certainly partisan, and other aspects where he would part company with what I think of as responsible journalism concern the security of individuals, indeed, who are named in many of his dumps, people who were put at risk. This is a hotly disputed issue, but I'm pretty well convinced by the way that it was, by the State Department's own troubles with Assange, because they attempted to engage with him about the individuals who might be put at risk by particularly dissident people in countries of great oppression, The fact that the details of the conversations that the American diplomats had with them was likely to be exposed in his dump, and he was particularly cavalier about that. The State Department were anxious to maintain the anonymity of these people, of course, because their lives would be at risk, and they had to take extraordinary measures to make them safe as the dump was about to happen. And Assange himself had showed no interest in protecting the lives of those people. And that's not what a principled journalist does.
No, and so his saga is not over. The visible part of it is over. It's going to be very interesting to see how long it's going to take to get him to American soil and face a charge, which really, once he's bought in, you know, they can't charge him with anything else when they bring him back in. But the charge is not for stealing information. It's basically
it's for hacking.
It's for the hacking, which
over the course of time made it just as things have developed in that arena and in the courts. I think that it would be different if it were about the secrets themselves, the actual publication. So there's a nuance there that I wait for.
Well, yes, the American authorities are trying now to be careful not to make it an issue of First Amendment rights. But of course, whether
it will be
succeed
anyway.
is a different matter. But they're trying to limit the accusation to hacking, breaking a security password, in other words, in a cyber intrusion that is very, you know, on the face of it, straightforwardly criminal.
The bad thing about this whole thing is that now the next person that tries to bring light to something that is an injustice, this will forever be compared to it simply because. And I really, you know, I really did admire him when he started.
But there are ways to do these things, and in a lot of cases, people kind of fall over their own hump.
But all I'm saying is this: it's just a bad harbinger of things, you know.
I don't know if he had been living. What I find fascinating, and David, this is where I always am conflicted about what people know versus what people know. There was a mistake. How long ago? Back in the fall, where the indictment that was under seal was unsealed.
By mistake.
By mistake.
Part of it was mistake.
Whatever it was.
A case entirely unrelated to Assange was opened up, and in the course of it was unsealed, and in the course of it, some material relating to the Assange case became clear too. So yeah, it became obvious that what some of the machinations were by American authorities to
get him back
Assange.
Here, basically to extradite him.
Absolutely, yeah. And the extradition case is now going to unfold, one that we could see coming right from the point that leak, because it was a leak, an unintended leak, but it was a leak, that revealed that this was in the works, and now it's working out.
And in that, let's call it revelation, I am guessing that it provoked certain responses on his part.
Well, sure, he took self-protective measures, which the Ecuadorians became aware of. I mean, the fact that they became aware of them because he was threatening. He was openly threatened. Well, not openly, but in the confines of his conversations with the Ecuadorian authorities, he was threatening all sorts of retaliation against his own hosts.
And
it all got very complicated, and the sweetness and light that may have existed at some point, it totally evaporated from the embassy.
And so then that's where it becomes, I was thinking this morning, right, who does the part twos of the movie? You know, is Edward Snowden enjoying himself in Russia? Who does, and this is for a lot of people who don't follow the entire arc but follow it piece by piece, you know, this is going to be the story of the sort of grungy, somewhat unstable guy who lived in an embassy for 7 years. You know, you're going to lose for a group.
With a messy cat.
Right. Yes. Well, you're going to lose the context.
But that's what I'm saying. That's what I mean. That's the bad thing about this happening. You're totally obscured now. If I'm obscured, I can imagine how people who don't understand, you're totally obscured that what the guy started out doing was truly magnificent. And it turns out that he looks...
He's human.
He's more than human. He's the heir. You know, it's just something that's really bad and sheds a bad light on people finding out that, yes, their phones and their everything are being tapped. It puts a bad light on all the information that was revealed about what governments do. And, yes, there's some bad things in it that shouldn't be revealed. But my Lord, it totally took something that was good and turned it something that turned
nothing,
absolutely negative.
Nothing is either just good or just bad. And if people haven't figured that out yet, they have some studying up to do. But I have mentioned this. I keep mentioning this to Marshall, so forgive me if I'm repeating. But I don't know if you remember long before this happened, back in the time that Marshall was talking about, there was a Saturday Night Live skit about Julian Assange going to stay in a friend's apartment. Did you ever see that?
No, I did not.
Okay. It was remarkably prescient, is all I'm going to say. And it's about 11 or 12 years
old.
Get him out of the apartment. And sure. When I see this, I keep flashing back to it because people don't change all that. You know, it's because it's always a mixed blessing, let's just say. You know, the individual who's doing something absolutely amazing inevitably has some personality quirks, no matter what, and no matter who.
Let it be said, the charges were dropped because the statute of limitations ran out because it was so difficult to pursue the inquiry. But I guess we shouldn't forget that the reason that he was in the embassy in the first place, that he was fleeing an extradition order from Sweden on sexual charges, yes, sexual assault and rape. He's a complicated human being, quite clearly, to put it mildly. We should be careful about someone who, you know, has tried to break the mold and do things at the beginning, very valuable, as Marshall was saying, purpose. As you say, human and made up of a complex mix of personality qualities that have not served him well.
Did he have, or did Wiki have anything to do with the Panama Papers?
No.
But they set them. They clearly wouldn't have happened without WikiLeaks.
That's
exactly right. So set it in motion.
And what's interesting about that is that when that major dump—it's not a word I really like using about this material—but but the 2010 revelations were orchestrated very effectively by a collaborative exercise that was international, included media organizations, especially newspapers of quality like the New York Times and the Guardian in London and other international journals of repute. And there was a very dedicated effort to get a sense of civic responsibility into the striking a balance, in other words, between the desire to reveal everything and, you know, journalistic propriety and sense of responsibility in what was revealed and how. Having mind of, you know, to matters like whose innocent lives were being put at risk at the time, and that kind of collaboration was a template that got set and used by later whistleblowers to great effect. And the Panama Papers is a very good example of that. But no, WikiLeaks didn't actually take part in that Panama Papers exercise, but they did help to set the template.
I have to move you from one very big personality to another. What do you think happened?
I can't think whom, but go ahead.
Bibi, what happened in Israel?
Bibi Netanyahu, yes. Well, he's back in office. longest serving Israeli prime minister since David Ben-Gurion, as a result. Extraordinary. But, I mean, the election has gone his way, although very close-run thing. And as usual, as very common at least in Israeli politics, he's only able to form a government now because of the Israeli propensity for making alliances, parliamentary alliances, lots of small parties, in his case, right-wing and religious right parties coming to his assistance and getting him back into the prime minister's chair. But of course, politics is one thing. The law is another. We'll see what happens when the case against him for corruption, him and his wife, starts to gain ground over the next few months.
Yeah.
His longitude, if that's the right word, longevity, I suppose, is the proper word, of his prime ministership is. He's going to be under question, I think. He may have to go, not because of the way that the votes and the Israeli parliamentary system decided, but the way that the Israeli law and the criminal prosecution decides it.
It's interesting. My trainer is a former member of the Israeli Defense Force, and he was in.
That sounds like a good trainer to have.
He really is. But he was in Israel last week. He came back and the other day, and I asked him about it, and he said it was the most amazing thing to him was he would speak to middle-aged and older people, and they were the ones who had questions about Netanyahu. They appreciated that things that Netanyahu had done, but they still had very serious reservations. But he was very surprised that 90% of the younger people he spoke to all wanted Netanyahu to win because he's made Israel, in their eyes, more secure. And it's interesting because in my trainer's eyes, he's taken Israel and just made it more insecure by his actions and the latest actions where they might access actually not only the Golan Heights but all the other occupied territories.
And his view is shared by many and other, and this is where it's always very interesting knowing someone and then covering it. And I find, I'm going to back up here, but I find that a huge problem with the personalization of many stories, and particularly in the paper of record, I've noticed. You know, it's many things.
You're speaking of my hometown newspaper.
I am speaking of your hometown newspaper, but just basically
over the last
the cableization of things and with the opinionization of things and with the infotainment grab an eyeball, you know. Gone are the apparent, obvious, except they're not really gone, you know, of sitting over a beverage and actually debating the points, political points, as we used to do in our salad days.
Aren't you great about one thing, though? Brexit hasn't come up at all.
No, but we've got a limerick that we have to do, and it has. And
well,
that's another really interesting.
The news out of London has been eclipsed. Brexit taking second place to Julian Assange. I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
I know.
I really can't tell.
It's recess. You know, and, but what is so funny is you could feel just when it became, we've got 2 minutes left, but when it became on the top, I don't know whether you want to talk about Brexit or the personalization of stories, but I think that any grown-up editors need to get back, you know, have your peeps start writing in the, not through the lens of how I feel about XYZ, but rather...
Personalization by the author, you mean, of personal views. Yeah, yeah, personal journalism is certainly cresting again. But it's never, you know, it's never far from the surface. I mean, it's a mode that, is forever with us. But it's gotten more and more deeply entrenched. It has to be said. It's not a mode I favor very much. Although, you know, some individuals are very good at it, and I welcome what they do. But,
right.
I tend, as I think I've said before on this show, you know, I tend to the Detective Friday version of journalism. Really, just the facts, man. Just the facts.
And then some. When I say smart, I don't mean just some coherent. You know, well analyzed opinion, you know, from based on those facts. Very happy for people who actually have the full story, or at least access to much more than the average bear, to write about it and to help shape people's views.
Yeah, individual skills and individual contacts are all of great value, and they should be encouraged But opinion journalism is all very well, but it's better when it's reported opinion journalism. When along with the opinion goes in some recitation of the facts that underlie whatever opinion you've come to. Reported opinion journalism is sort of rare on the ground, but very good when you see it. There are instances, I'm trying to think of individual names now, and none are coming to this aging brain, but you know it when you see it. It's like an elephant, you know, it's when you see it, it's quite indisputable that you're looking at something which has been thoroughly reported as well as coming through the filter of someone's opinions.
Well, we'll see what we look at next week at this time.
Happy Easter.
And to you.
No. It's early yet, but I was just saying.
We're getting ready for it, right?
I bought
my first Easter egg already, so I'm well on the road.
Your celebratory Easter recess.
Well, we'll hippity hop to next week.
All right. Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, The Media Beat.
Thank you.